Mrs. Eleanor Swent continuing the interview with Vincent Perry on March 13th, 1990. When you say that you, well, so you could wander around and you could chip off a few pieces of this and that without problems, but then when you say we drilled holes, we had to
have a tie on the ground, definitely.
Then you had to bring somebody else in, a drill or a team.
We had to bring, usually we had a relations with different diamond drill contracting groups, and we arranged a drilling program. This
That's
meant
a
also
whole
different thing, and one of the problems, likely as not, was to develop enough of a water supply so you could do drilling. In that desert country south of Tucson, water was at a minimum, and you had to develop a water supply, and you had to develop access and the camps for the drillers. It was more or less a routine matter, but those things were usually handled by the contractor.
It didn't just happen, no.
Yeah. No.
You had to get authorization from New York or someplace?
Well, we had to get, usually those things were always budgeted. We'd get an allocation of money from New York to carry on the work.
Mm-hmm. And you could go ahead.
And then we could go ahead,
and
spend the money as needed.
Get shot at by an irate rancher?
No, I think there was one case where Bob Lynn, who had been brought down from the Grants operation and was working at, I believe, at that time up in Utah. And he had a run-in with some claim owner who said that Lynn was trespassing on his ground, and there was a little argument, but it didn't get down to the point where they were shooting at each other.
Didn't have the hazards of marijuana growers down there.
No, no, I think they're a lot more dangerous than adverse claim owners in generally in the western mining districts.
I understand that. Okay, so you drilled the...
As a matter of fact, we'll just as a complete change from the scene we were discussing. Several years ago, I heard about a gold prospect just south of Carmel, and I drove down along the Big Sur Mountains with my sister and another lady, and we went, followed a road back into the hills. It was a steep and mean grade. I heard a motorcycle coming around the bend just ahead of us, and a real tough-looking character challenged me and said, "What are you doing up here?" I didn't like his looks, and I was with these two other women, and I thought the best thing to do was to get out of that place. So we drove on back, and we stopped at Recreation Center just south of Big Sur, and the man in charge there, I told him the story, and he said, "You're smart to get out of that place." He said, "They're growing marijuana up there," and he said, "They're a pretty tough bunch." Mm-hmm. He said, we don't dare go up there.
Goodbye.
So I think the Coast Range of California, with all its beautiful scenic attractions has a rough element underneath it that we hear little about, but it's there.
Yes. Yes. I think it's one of the hazards for field geologists.
I think
actually.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
it
so.
It is. Yes. Things they don't teach you in your geology course in school.
Well, when we were going to Berkeley, we'd certainly gone up and looked at places like that, and I'm quite sure there'd have been no difficulty in getting around. That was in the days before marijuana and other drugs were the in thing in a lot of our society.
So the Twin Buttes prospect, then you went.
We went ahead with the
20 years later.
The mine with sinking the shaft, and we Nabel designed the open pit based upon both surface drill results and the underground work.
Now, were you still in charge of it?
Well, at that, when the pit was designed, it became an operation, and I was not in charge of that. That was under the mining department, and Nabel was reporting directly to the mining department.
Now, is there a definite point at which you're told that it's?
Well,
no,
I think
yours?
It's pretty. It's usually quite evident where the cutoff is, as long as you're. You're exploring and developing where geology is the primary consideration. It's a function of the geological department. As soon as it reaches a stage where large sums of money have to be expended to establish an actual operation, it is no longer a proper function of the geological department. Although the geological department, just as it does in the mines of Butte, Montana, or as it did in the big open pits in South America, has a function as an operating adjunct to the mining department. The geologists in Butte particularly have a day-to-day function because they have to point the crosscuts and drifts whenever a vein is cut off by a fault, and the problem is to pick up the faulted extension of the vein, usually a matter of crosscutting a few feet or maybe a few hundred feet. And these are all directed by the geologist. The system, as it has been developed in by Anaconda, is to have a set of written recommendations. The geologist writes the recommendation. It's approved by the mine foreman or the mine superintendent or both. And the geologist supervises the direction of the work, how far the crosscut should be driven, when it should be stopped. All those decisions are geological decisions, even though they're carried out by the mine operator. And this system has worked very well. It's a matter of coordination and cooperation between the mine operator and the mine geologist.
Now, when you were promoted, took Sales's job in Salt Lake, were you in charge of all geologists then?
Yes.
In the mine in Anaconda, as well as the exploration?
As well as the exploration and the mines in South America and any place where Anaconda had a mining operation.
You hired them and supervised them?
Correct.
Both at the operations and in exploration?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep.
but the geologist who's attached to an operation has a different job from the one who's in exploration.
Generally, that's true, yes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Did you have anything to do with deciding, for example, that Twin Buttes or Haystack would be an open pit or an underground mine?
Yes. There was very definite input by the Geological Department in questions of that type. And sometimes there were some very strong opinions and prejudices involved, particularly on the part of the operators. Mm-hmm. They, of course, were always looking for the technique that would produce the lowest cost, and of course there was nothing wrong with that. We were all interested in low cost, but the geologist had a longer range viewpoint. He was considering what might happen 15 or 20 years later, and how it would affect the operation for the long pull.
And what difference would that make?
Well, it was, I think, the best example is Chuquicamata. And we might just discuss this in connection with the whole story of Chuquicamata, because in a way it's probably the most useful function, the single function the geologists did at Chuquicamata. My first trip to Chuquicamata was in 1944, and at that time the operation was strictly on oxide ore, rich, high-grade material which was had been purchased from the Guggenheim interests several years before by Anaconda, and was being mined by open pit methods. The only work that had been done, of course, it was evident that there must be rich sulfide ore underneath this beautiful oxide showing, was the three drill hole project that Sales had launched there in 1932 when he made his first visit to Chuquicamata. And those three holes showed good sulfide ore, extensive both laterally and vertically under all this oxide. It was his report on those holes that was delivered to the Anaconda head men at that period. Anaconda was suffering from the drastic break in the price of copper to 4 cents a pound. And there was a question whether it could survive. Mr. Kelly took Sales logs of the three rich holes that had penetrated the sulfide zone, showed them to some of the bankers that were thinking no doubt about foreclosing on Anaconda loans, and said, "Now, gentlemen, this is what we have here. Do you want to try to run this kind of a mine, or will you continue to let us run it even though we are heavily in debt?" And the bankers wisely said that they preferred that Anaconda try to operate itself out of its present tight financial position. But this gets back again to the subject of how you mine a great ore body like Chuquicamata. By 1952, I had made other trips to South America, and My good friend and classmate at Columbia, Charles Brinkerhoff, had then moved up to the position of general manager at Chuukki, so I found in him a very friendly and a responsive person to discuss the problems of geology and mining. And the discussion revolved around whether it was better to move at an early stage underground to get at a lot of this high-grade sulfide ore by underground block cave mining. Brinkerhoff's position was, I believe, right from the start that it was better to continue open pit mining, even though there, for the short term, there might be periods when the grades would fluctuate and the returns from operations might not be as consistent as they would have been if more ground had was opened up for mining. But I asked, I assigned Glenn Waterman to the job of being geologist there at Chuukki, and he immediately got together with Brinkerhoff and made a thorough study of the detailed distribution of sulfides versus oxides, drilled several holes along what we called the West Fissure Zone, which controlled the better grade copper mineralization. And on the basis of those studies, which were done with the full collaboration of Brinkerhoff, it was decided that the pit design should prevail, and that the Anaconda Company should continue with the program as it had been laid out earlier, forgetting any idea of going underground until much later in the history of the mining there.
Now you say it was decided. Who decided?
Well, it was decided finally by Clyde Weed, who was then in charge of mining operations for the Anaconda Company. But Weed was very much interested in the alternate proposal, and one of the things that was influencing him was that he, perhaps more than most of us, appreciated the political situation that was developing in Chile particularly, and indicated that Anaconda may not have a long period in which to continue mining this greatest ore deposit in the world. And he wondered whether it would be better to go underground and to mine not only high grade from the oxide zone at the surface, but high grade from the sulfide zone below to maximize the total production that could be obtained out of Chuukki Kamada before it was expropriated. Brinkerhoff, on the other hand, was looking at it from the long-range viewpoint, and he said there was only one thing that we could properly assume, and that was that we would continue to own the properties, and we should have an engineering plan that went ahead on sound mining principles, and that an open pit was dictated by the application of those principles to the situation that existed there. And it wasn't many years later that the company did lose that great mine. It's a question whether they would have been better off going to an open pit or going to underground or staying with the open pit. I think as we look at it in historical perspective, it was just as well that we followed Brinckerhoff's advice and did it like good miners and with the maximum effort to do the job correctly from an engineering viewpoint. But those are situations that involve a lot of factors, and they have to be decided by the top mining men in the company, and that's why it's very necessary to have mining men at the helm of a big mining corporation in order to chart its course. And it gets back to the problems that Anaconda faced later on when the banks, unlike the attitude they had in 1932 when they allowed the chief executive officer of the Anaconda to continue a mining operation even in the face of financial losses, that when the recession of 1975 and 76 came along, the price of copper dropped, Anaconda was severely in debt because of the gigantic efforts it had been making to try to replace chili production by bringing in the operation at Twin Buttes, by trying to expand the bulk mining operations at Butte, and also faced with the extremely burdensome costs of environmental protection, which had become necessary because of the environmental restrictions placed upon mining operations, pollution of the air and water, which were certainly happening in Montana. All of those costs put the company severely in debt, so that the banks were in a position to call the turn. And when in due course men of the caliber of Weed and Brinckerhoff had been retired, the Chase Manhattan Bank decided that the vice chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank would become the chief executive officer of Anaconda. And his only knowledge of mining was an extremely cursory one, so he hired consulting firms made up of bright young men who had graduated in business administration from some of our prestigious schools, and they advised him what to do with the Anaconda operation, the net result of which was that in trying to cut the payroll, they cut some of the ablest men in the company or gave them early retirement. And the only positive action they were interested in was listening to the offers that were being made by the Atlantic Richfield Company that they would take over the Anaconda Company on a share stock exchange plus cash. In other words, the bank was interested in money alone, and it's typical of the kind of thing that goes on today in our business world, where that same sort of philosophy prevails, and little attention is paid to the pleas of management to stick with sound technical operations and not let the fate of the company hinge upon a possibly short-lived financial position.
You were just, wait a minute, yeah, we were just talking about the problems of running a mining company with bankers, and you know, there was this theory that management was management, and it didn't matter whether you were managing a mine or a university.
Well, but this is not true. You have to have some specialized knowledge and particularly a lot of experience in a particular field in order to do a decent job, and this shows up in the activities and the successes and failures of mining companies. It's just illustrative of the kind of thing that we face all through our economic structures, and the problems of leveraged buyouts and consolidations and takeovers that are the fashion in the financial world today are ignoring some of the basic tenets of good performance by saying that the fundamental principles of the capitalism are all that are required, that you just go ahead and use the outcome of the bottom line as the one and only test of whether a thing has been successful or not. This isn't the case at all. And the history of Anaconda is an excellent illustration of it. As long as the company was being run on sound principles of management. In fact, I can go back to my freshman days at the University of California, and one of the first books I happened to come across was Herbert Hoover's Principles of Mining. Herbert Hoover was an excellent, highly competent and successful mining engineer, and his little book, The Principles of Mining, gave the whole story and showed how the specialized phases of mining relate to the overall outcome of a well-run mining effort. He performed those kind of jobs in Australia as a young mining engineer out of Stanford University, and he was very successful in applying them, and they are the same principles that should be applied today in operating a big company, even one as large as Anaconda, that was vertically integrated from mine to consumer. The mines were there, but there was an interrelationship between mining, metallurgy, fabrication, and selling the product to the public, that was all part of the function of a great mining company. And when the details of how those functions should be operated efficiently and how they could be integrated with each other was forgotten or slighted. That was where trouble began to appear. Perhaps it's an over-exaggeration to say that that was the final cause of the liquidation of the Anaconda Company, but it certainly contributed to it, even though the cataclysm that occurred in the loss of all their rich Chilean mines was the start of the disaster. I compare it, for example, with the experience that we talked about earlier in this interview, the destruction of San Francisco. The earthquake was the thing that triggered the San Francisco disaster, just as the loss of the great Chilean mines triggered the destruction of Anaconda, but it was the actual series of events that followed the earthquake, the disastrous fires that destroyed San Francisco, just as it was a series of related events that ultimately destroyed Anaconda. Rather comparable.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, where do we want to go? We've talked about Chuki. We might say a few more words about the geological work at Chuquicamata, because I think it was interesting that so much was accomplished there in a relatively short time. The geological department not only did a masterful job in helping out on the operation of the big open pit and the decision to concentrate on open pit techniques, but it also developed a important extension of the ore body called the North Pampa deposit. This is about 5 kilometers north of Chuquicamata on the same general trend of the porphyry intrusive that contains the rich ore in the parent mine. In addition to the south, a large ore body called the Exotica was developed. This was not primarily a discovery by the geological department. It was actually found by the metallurgists when they were doing some test drilling in the vicinity of the oxide plant. However, the geological implications of results obtained from those operating holes were used in projecting back towards the source of the ore and a large oxide ore body was ultimately drilled out. Another important development near Chuqui was the El Abra deposit. This was an old deposit, had been known for many years but had never been drilled. Anaconda did enough drilling there to indicate that this is a major good grade copper deposit, and it will no doubt be mined someday by whoever operates in Chile in the future. A large deposit, several hundred kilometers north of Chuqui, was found at El Quebrada Blanca. This was also drilled, and since Anaconda's exit from Chile has been further developed, and there's considerable interest by several companies in and the Chilean government in this occurrence. In all of these jobs, there were studies made by Glenn Waterman of the important relationships between porphyry intrusions and copper mineralization, which have contributed a great deal to the general knowledge of copper geology, and were carried out in conjunction with the research work done by Charles Myers and others in the Butte Research Laboratory.
And again, I think some of this exploration was done by airplane, wasn't it?
Yes, we did a photographic study of the entire belt from the Peruvian border to south of Puerto Rios, and photographed in color the ground along the trend of the West Fissure. Some of these developments involved use of such colored imagery.
Did you have to then hire people who had special knowledge of these, interpreting these?
No, we did our own interpreting, but we of course hired people to do the flying and to do the photographing. This was a special job that we had no ability to handle ourselves, but we used the photographs ourselves to do the interpreting.
And you didn't have to learn any new skills in
Oh, China? No, not necessary. No, no, those are things that generally are taught in schools and available in some of the textbooks.
Had you been taught this?
No, I learned it, I guess, from experience as I went along. It was before I went to school before the days when those things were taught.
What about the scintillometer? You mentioned that earlier. Did this involve learning new techniques?
No, no, no. It's a very easy thing to operate. It's just a device that records radioactivity.
But interpreting the results is something you have to...
Yes, you have to know a little bit about the interpretation, but it isn't too serious.
Let's go back.
We pretty well covered that, but this research, let me just refer to, because this can be pretty brief.
And then you had mentioned Australia and... Canada, those were a little parts of your activities?
Well, I covered this Australian thing pretty well right here in a few words. Ready to go?
Mm-hmm. We're all right. All wired for
well,
action.
there were numerous prospects that we tested and did some exploration work.
Now, by this time, were you living in New York?
I was living in New York. Yes, mm-hmm. I'd moved to New York in 1956,
mm-hmm.
and I was working out of New York.
Where did you live?
In New York?
Mm-hmm.
We had an apartment
You were in the city?
Gracie Terrace in Manhattan.
Okay.
Overlooking the East River. Nice view and the air was relatively fresh and clean because it was carried on the southerly winds that swept up the East River. So we were happy there. The only disadvantage, according to my wife, was that it was very difficult to get taxicab service in that somewhat isolated part of Manhattan. So we finally moved over to Park Avenue, where we acquired an apartment, and I'm living there at present time.
Now, I had a Long Island address for you also.
We bought a place out in Long Island at West Hampton in order to get out of the city on weekends and enjoy the country. And since my retirement, I've spent a great deal of my time out there. In fact, most of my time is spent there. I like to garden and I like the ocean and the general environment. Prefer it to the mad rush in those concrete canyons that are called New York City.
But you kept your Park Avenue apartment.
Kept the Park Avenue apartment, yeah.
And your daughter lives
here. My daughter lives near me in New York City on 78th Street.
Quite a change, though, from Salt Lake, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. All right, well, excuse me for that little diversion, but so then you were directing exploration all over the place, including Australia.
Let me just correct that. You caught me off guard on my my daughter's address. It's 17 East 84th Street, near the Metropolitan Museum.
Oh, nice. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Nice. Uh-huh. So, well, that's nice that you were able to keep your family near anyway.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So, you were flying off to Australia and...
And we did considerable investigating in Australia, but did not become involved in any major exploration. We developed one mine, the Red Ross, south of Kalgoorlie in Western Australia. It was a nickel property and produced for a considerable time. I don't know whether it's still in operation or not.
Mm-hmm.
Was this one that you acquired that somebody else had
No, we did the initial exploration on it. Yeah. Worked it from the outcrop. Mm-hmm. We did exploration on a low-grade nickel prospect north of Kalgoorlie, which showed rather extensive mineralization, and but the grades were, in my opinion, submarginal. It may be that with further development, this could become a likely prospect. But again, I have no information as to what has been done there recently. In Canada, we acquired the Britannia mine north of Vancouver. It was an old mine and supposedly worked out, but additional work demonstrated that there were extensions of the ore, and we operated a mill there and had a small mine operation. In eastern Canada, we had a property near Bathurst, which was put in production, and is, as far as I know, still operating, although I question whether it amounts to a great deal. In Western Ontario, we opened up the Nakina iron deposit, and Jack Nabel was up there and managed that. We drilled and evaluated it, and subsequently sold it to Canadian steel interests in the early 1970s. Under Glenn Waterman's supervision, we did extensive exploration for bauxite in connection with Anaconda's aluminum operations, and there were some attractive showings developed in Jamaica, in Australia, but Anaconda depended on a joint venture with Alcan and Kaiser in Jamaica for a principal source of its raw materials to supply the aluminum operation. So there was nothing very startling or new about our developments in that area. I think one of the real contributions that the Anaconda Geological Department made to geology and to the mining industry was the work it did in coordinating field investigations with laboratory analysis. Sales was instrumental in starting this, and secured a high-class young student, Charles Meyer from Harvard University, to head up the Butte Research Laboratory beginning in the late 1940s. Meyer, in collaboration with Sales, wrote several important landmark papers on rock alteration in Butte, and also generally
excuse me just a minute, but the microphone is picking up the noise of those pages turning, so let's be careful not to, maybe if you unclip them it would be, because it's, that rustling sound is a little distracting.
Yeah, it's static.
Right, uh-huh, sorry.
The, no, I think I know where I, but where I am. There were several men engaged at the various times in this research, all of them under the general supervision of Charles Meyer.
When you talk about geological research, what are you doing? Sort of chemical analysis?
Chemical analysis and microscopic investigations, largely. Particularly, the microscope is extremely useful in identifying minerals and in establishing the relationships between the various mineral assemblages. Meyer was extremely adept at this work, and his ideas reflected the teaching of Grattan at Harvard, and the experience that he gained by applying these particular research procedures to the field problems in the Butte mines and in other mines that were owned by Anaconda. For example, he made a trip with me to Chuquicamata and spent a considerable time there in association with Glenn Waterman in studying the porphyry copper responsible for the great Chuquicamata ore body. He had marvelous opportunities to observe and to collect sample material. All of this material was shipped back to Butte and was thin sections and polished surface sections were made of the individual specimens, and these were studied microscopically. In doing it, Meyer came to some important conclusions which have generally been applied throughout the mining industry. There's been a voluminous outpouring of literature by various individuals who refer almost invariably to the basic work that was done in the Butte Laboratory. Anaconda also maintained a excellent laboratory at El Salvador in Chile. And John Hunt and Lou Gustafson, both PhDs, who had worked under and with Meyer, were in charge of that laboratory, and their publication on the geology of the El Salvador mine is a benchmark in the development of modern theory as to the genesis of porphyry coppers.
So they were going beyond just identifying them.
Oh yes, they were actually involved in a philosophical approach to why these things happen and the processes involved in the, you might say, the anatomy of an ore body. Useful tools to be applied in exploration work where you get the indications that are the basis for the studies made by laboratory men. It's, I think, a very important and useful tool, as well as a means of making scientific progress. In many ways, the study of an ore body is akin to the work a biologist does on the anatomy of a human being, and the knowledge gained that way can be applied in geology just as it is in medicine. Now,
did you ever have to justify the expense of this laboratory?
Yes, of course it was necessary to justify it.
Right.
And
did you have any problems, I guess?
Well, I found out that the board of directors Anaconda, and by that time I was serving on the board, were extremely interested and willing to support scientific research. I never had any difficulty getting financial support for any laboratory or investigative procedure that I proposed. And this was one useful function of being on the board. One of the other things that I was able to do that met with the approval of the directors was to bring in men of the caliber of Meyer and Hunt, Gustafson, and others to talk to the board about the nature of their research work, so that the people that were putting up the money understood exactly what we were trying to do. And those talks were universally received with favor. So I felt that this was a good way to advance the science of geology.
How did your going on the board change your perception of the company, or did it change?
Well, it didn't change it. I found that the board, as I knew it in those days, and that was in the 60s, was composed of men, particularly the company representatives on the board, that is, the company employees that were on the board, the officers of the company, were men that I had known intimately and had worked with, and it was just a continuation of the years of experience that I had already had with them.
Were there...
There were outside directors, which, that was a little different story, but and that was one of the reasons I brought in some of the men of my department to address the board and show them the nature of our work, and particularly the research end of it, so that they could appreciate that we were doing things for the long term that were not going to produce any immediate dividend, but that might be applicable at some later time in the actual exploration for an ore deposit.
Did